Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, with the presidential election in sight, Donald Trump is now claiming that if he doesn't win, the thing must be rigged. It's concerning that his supporters may believe that, but also concerning that others might imagine that the fact that Trump mentions the idea of voting improprieties must mean there is no such thing. Ari Berman has been following voting rights for years. He's a senior contributing writer at The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll talk with him about voting in 2016. Also on the show, explosive entitlement spending, runaway national debt. These are familiar boogeymen for elite media, but how much there is there? Dean Baker will join us to unpack the oft-heard media phrase, debt and entitlements, and explain what it really means to call for cutting them. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and writes the blog Beat the Press. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. What do poverty, education, LGBTQ rights, campaign finance reform, and gun violence have in common? They're all urgent issues that merit high-level attention. And they're all issues completely ignored by corporate media moderators in all of the presidential and vice presidential debates. It says a great deal that media think the next president needn't be asked about the 49 million people in this country who live in households lacking means to get enough nutritious food on a regular basis. But another topic stands out as a non-factor. Climate change was not the subject of a single question in any of 2016's election debates. Overall, the phrase climate change was mentioned a total of four times, all passing references from Hillary Clinton. Climate change or climate disruption threatens everything: the economy, national security, and health. It exacerbates poverty and racism, and it demands action and leadership. Transitioning to the post-fossil fuel future, which is the only future, is a monumental endeavor with lots of elements to be socially decided. Elite media's evident notion that they can just whistle past it is the height of irresponsibility. But it's not just the debates. Media genuinely interested in the mega issue of climate disruption would be all over Standing Rock, where thousands of Native Americans and others have been illustrating what it looks like to take seriously the scientific consensus that addressing the problem, as they say, means keeping it in the ground. A North Dakota district judge dismissed riot charges against Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman. In so doing, Judge John Grinsteiner stood up for the First Amendment, which is more than you can say for most corporate journalists. Goodman reported on the use of pepper spray and attack dogs against demonstrators, including children, opposing the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. For that act of journalism, she was charged by North Dakota's state's attorney with criminal trespassing, and then, perhaps realizing that wouldn't stick, with participation in a riot, based on the contention that Goodman was not acting as a journalist because everything she reported on was from the position of justifying the protest actions. Social and independent media had the story, but vanishingly few commercial media journalists showed concern or even interest in a fellow reporter being criminally charged for doing her job. AP ran a news story that got some pickup, but it was columnist Will Bunch at Philadelphia Daily News, the LA Times' Michael Hiltzik, and Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi who actually defended Goodman's right to report. Corporate media are content to complain about Donald Trump's wild attacks on the press as having an agenda to elect the crooked Hillary Clinton. But the only effective response to threats against freedom of the press is solidarity. If those with the biggest megaphones don't stand up to the already occurring efforts to clamp down on the press, someday they might be writing poems beginning, "First they came for independent reporters, and I didn't say anything because I wasn't an independent reporter." There's still a chance for elite media. They could report on documentary filmmaker Dia Schlossberg, still facing up to 45 years in prison based on her reporting on the Dakota Access protests. As Fair's Jim Narikas put it, The First Amendment you save may be your own. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It's hard to pick the most ominous or disturbing thing Donald Trump has said, but his call for supporters to go and watch polling places in certain areas because you know what I'm talking about is up there. But Trump's claim that the election is rigged, unless he wins, in which case it isn't, didn't spring full-blown from his head. Republicans have claimed voter fraud benefiting their opponents for a long time. And for a long time, corporate media have set those claims, alongside concerns about voter suppression of African Americans and immigrants in particular, as though they were equally grounded or just analogous partisan gripes. Now, as we look toward the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, where and what are the real concerns? Ari Berman is a senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me back, Janine.
Well, we can't get pulled into saying, obviously, it's nutsy for anyone to have any concerns about impropriety in the voting system. You know, nobody who remembers Florida in 2000 wants to say that exactly. It's a matter of defining what the problems are that we're talking about. And you have written about the connection, actually, about how we got from Florida in 2000 to where we're at today. And I wonder if you could talk about what happened. What happened there?
I think you're right that people are confusing a number of different issues. They're confusing problems in our election system that are resulting from disenfranchisement, and they're saying that's the same thing as voter fraud, attempts to illegally vote. What we saw in Florida 2000 was there was a lot of different problems. I mean, obviously people know about hanging chads and butterfly ballots and Catherine Harris, et cetera, but there was another part of the election that didn't get a lot of coverage, which is that the state of Florida did a massive voter purge. They claimed that all of these ex-felons were on the voting rolls and needed to be purged. Florida was one of only a few states that didn't allow ex-felons to be able to vote. And the problem was this purge was done in both an inaccurate and a discriminatory way. And after the election, we learned, because the NAACP sued the state, that 12,000 registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting. And that was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory. And I think that was a clear example of voter disenfranchisement. However, it was spun by the Bush administration, by conservatives, as they realized that manipulating the country's voting laws could give them a partisan advantage, and that talking about voter fraud, whether or not the fraud actually existed, was the way to build support for those restrictions. So ironically, instead of saying we can never allow this disenfranchisement to happen again after the 2000 election in Florida, it became more likely that this would occur because Republicans saw it as a way to benefit them politically.
And we saw in the wake of that a number of actual policy moves in terms of new laws introduced, and we're still dealing with that today.
Yeah, well, we've seen really an explosion of these laws following the election of Barack Obama as president. And when Republicans gained control of many states in the 2010 election, they began to introduce a whole variety of new voting restrictions, whether it was strict voter ID laws or cutting back early voting or eliminating same-day voter registration or purging the voting rolls, all of these things. And really, they gave this one-size-fits-all description for it, which was that they were trying to combat voter fraud, even though voter fraud is a very, very small problem in American elections. And voter impersonation, which is the kind of thing a voter ID law would stop, is exceedingly rare, as we've heard a lot about recently, the fact that there's only 31 cases of voter impersonation out of a billion votes cast. So by any objective measure, voter fraud is not a big problem in American elections, but it's been a manufactured controversy that's been used to pass all of these new laws, making it harder to vote.
Where do you see actual problems or concerns?
Well, I just got back from Wisconsin, which is one state that has a strict voter ID law, and I'm seeing a tremendous amount of problems here. Basically, the main issue is that people are being required to be able to get strict forms of ID. They're being required to get underlying documents like birth certificates, for example, that can be extremely burdensome to people who don't have them. And the courts in Wisconsin have repeatedly said to the state that you have to make it easy for people to get IDs. But when I went to Wisconsin, I both talked to voters who made multiple trips to the DMV and weren't given voter IDs, and I also got recordings from the DMV that showed that they were just giving out wrong information over and over on a very systematic basis to voters. And even after the federal courts ordered them to make this ID accessible, the DMV and the Scott Walker's administration in Wisconsin admitted that they basically did nothing. So we're in a situation where new restrictions are either in effect or even in places where they're no longer in effect or where they've been softened, Republican states are just ignoring these court orders. So I'm concerned about the fact that in places like Wisconsin, people are not being issued the IDs they need to vote. In states like Ohio, people have been purged from the voting rolls. They've supposedly been reinstated by the courts, but we'll see what happens when they show up. In Texas, the courts relaxed that state's voter ID law, but Texas is still claiming falsely that people need ID to be able to vote, strict ID to be able to vote. So I think there's a bunch of different states that could be problematic, and these are just the states that we know about. It's very possible that there'll be issues, long lines, not enough polling machines, polling places changing in states that we're not even aware of come election day.
Yeah, I was looking at Texas where, you know, they had this strict photo ID rule, and then there was a victory. There was an alternative to that. They had to institute a way that you didn't need to follow this strict voter ID and that you would still be allowed to vote. And yet that nominal victory on the ground, it seems like it's not playing out that way.
Well, the state has just been extremely resistant to every single court order. And it's important to know that in Texas, their voter ID law would have been blocked and was blocked under the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act. So really, this law really should have never seen the light of day to begin with. And instead, we've now seen 5 years of litigation. There's a few different problems. One, Texas is basically emphasizing that you need strict ID, and a poll just came out that said that 44% of people think it's required. So that's problematic because if people don't have these forms of ID or don't believe they have them, they might not show up in the first place. And other people who can legally vote may not have their votes counted. Then you have officials in the state of Texas saying they're going to prosecute or investigate anyone who signs an affidavit, which is the kind of the fallback mechanism if you don't have strict ID. So what the courts thought of as a remedy, as a safety net, is being turned into a mechanism for Texas to prosecute people, which I just find so incredibly disturbing.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I don't really personally feel that mainstream media anyway have done a great job of separating false concerns from real concerns. It seems kind of a muddle when you look at it. But if you're talking to journalists between now and the election about not who's more presidential, but about the voting process itself, what would you like them to be pursuing or pointing at?
Well, I mean, I think the media have done a pretty good job of debunking Trump's rigged election statements,
right. But
I don't think they've gone to the second part of it, which we've been discussing, which is there actually is an attempt to undermine the integrity of the election. It's just it's not being done by Democrats, it's being done by Trump's people, by Republicans. And so I think they need to be a lot more aggressive. For example, this Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, was all over cable news after he said the election wouldn't be rigged in Ohio. Well, nobody asked him, what about the fact that you purged illegally 1 million voters from the rolls? I think it's great that there has been some pushback about the myth of voter fraud, but I think it's very unfortunate that the media hasn't been diving deeper into the legitimate disenfranchisement efforts and asking people, will every eligible voter be able to cast a ballot? Because I'm still very concerned that's not going to be the case.
Ari Berman is a senior contributing writer for The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Thank you very much, Ari Berman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot, Janine.
The announcement that one agenda item for the final presidential debate would be debt and entitlements was not surprising. Debt and entitlements, linked together that way, are always on corporate media's agenda. But though the terms are tossed around a lot, they're rarely unpacked or explained. In place of facts, we get fear. The Chicago Tribune said if they could inject one debate question, it would be, quote, "Secretary Clinton, Mr. Trump, you have children. Why aren't you scared?" Close quote. While Americans face many serious challenges, are runaway national debt and entitlements one of them? We're joined now by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where you'll find his blog, Beat the Press. And he's the author of, most recently, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I believe I have been asking you to break down media confusion on this issue for at least a decade now. It's clearly a very useful confusion for some people, and it's persistent. Well, first of all, the word entitlement, if we can start with that, at this point is basically a pejorative and almost a thought stopper. You know, what are people really talking about when they talk about entitlements, or specifically about cutting runaway entitlements?
Yeah, I mean, the use of the word itself, you know, as you say, it is a pejorative, and, you know, I gather most of the people using it know that, if not actually a pejorative. It's to avoid saying Social Security, Medicare. That's long and short, because those are the bulk of the items that fill that entitlement category. Entitlement's a budget term. You know, budget wonks in Washington all know what it is, and, you know, probably are being very neutral when they use it. But when the larger public hears that, and certainly when you're talking about a national debate of the presidential candidates, that is a large public audience. These are not mostly budget wonks. They're thinking entitlements. You know, someone's getting something for nothing. They're not thinking Social Security and Medicare. So if you just rephrased all this, oh, Social Security and Medicare, are you going to cut these? Odds are you get a much different reaction, because these are hugely popular programs across the political spectrum. Republicans support these programs pretty much in the same numbers as Democrats. So you'd have a very different debate if everyone understood they're asking about cutting Social Security and Medicare.
Absolutely. I mean, Social Security is paying benefits now to tens of millions of people, of seniors, of people with disabilities, and I understand 1 in 10 American children. So it's clearly a very different conversation if you talk about it in those terms, although, of course, there's a whole set of, you know, fear-mongering around Social Security itself. Well, I cited that Chicago Tribune editorial, but you really can open any paper on a given day and find a piece saying, "Our national debt is outrageous. Who will think of the children?" You know, now I understand there's new data that is being read as supporting that idea. What's going on here with the deep concerns? I've heard we're headed toward doom, you know, in terms of national debt. What are they talking about?
Well, you know, the implication is that somehow there's this explosive debt that just can be this massive burden on our kids. And, you know, you could beat this up any number of different ways, and I and others have. You know, most immediately, the debt does impose some burden that we have to pay interest on the debt. So every year, you know, a certain amount of money has to go to pay interest rather than, you know, paying for programs like Medicare or, you know, education, other things that we might value. And the reality is that the money we're paying in interest is actually very low today. It's about 0.8% of GDP. It comes to around $150 billion a year. Now, it sounds like a lot of money. But if you go back to the early 90s, we were paying over 3% of GDP in interest. That would be on the order of $550 billion a year. So we're actually paying much less interest today. The reason's simply being that we have very low interest rates in the economy. So debt's not a burden that way. The other point, if, you know, we go for the classic economic story, a large deficit is supposed to crowd out private investment by pushing up interest rates. So the story would be, if we have a real high deficit, we're going to have high interest rates, and then we won't have investment. And that's going to be bad for our kids because, you know, instead of businesses investing, becoming more productive, we're spending all our money on, you know, Social Security and Medicare, they'd say. So good for the people on Social Security and Medicare, but our kids will be poorer because of that. Well, A, interest rates are actually extremely low today. So they're lower than anyone expected them to be. So clearly that's not the obstacle. The other point, and, you know, I and others, I mean, even the International Monetary Fund makes this point, we've actually been restrained in our growth because the deficits have not been large enough. You know, ever since the collapse of the housing bubble 2007, 2008, we've been operating well below our potential level of output. And the significance of that is that when the economy is weaker, firms invest less. So when we're concerned about this investment story, we actually should want a larger deficit, both because, you know, the deficit can directly increase investment. You know, we build up our infrastructure, we improve education, which also increases productivity. Mm-hmm. But also, by spending more, we could crowd private investment in. So the economy is actually considerably smaller today because we haven't been running larger deficits than, you know, would have been projected, or I should say was projected 10 years ago. So we're not helping our kids by keeping the deficit down. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, and I think part of the problem there has to do with the recourse to, you know, a personal analog. You don't want to be in debt. That's bad for you, right? For your household income or something like that. And that's not really a... Of course, if you're paying money to go to school, you know, then it might make sense to have some debt as an individual, but it's just not a useful analog, and it's one that politicians and pundits often seem to take recourse in.
Yeah, they jump to that all the time, and, you know, it's understandable from the standpoint of a politician because most people aren't thinking about the economy and how big the government is and its role in the economy. So, you know, we all understand we can't keep adding $1,000 to our credit card debt every month. We can get in trouble at some point if we do that. And, you know, you go, okay, well, the government's like that. Well, the government's not like that. I mean, first of all, the government, at least we don't expect it to die. You know, so basically the story is that it should be there pretty much forever. I make the analogy, I go, at least let's think of a corporation, you know, General Electric. If the CEO of General Electric went to his board and said, oh, you know, we didn't make any money last year, but we paid off our debt, they would look at him like he's nuts. Right. You know, they want to make profit. They don't care about the debt. Point being that General Electric expects to be around forever. Maybe they won't be, but, you know, they're acting as though they do, and certainly the government has reason to believe it will be around forever. So we don't have to pay off the debt, you know, so that's one part. But the other part is that the government has a responsibility for supporting the economy. No one in their right mind should think, oh, I better spend another $100 this month because otherwise we as individuals can't influence the economy. The government can, and when there's not enough demand in the economy, the government absolutely has the responsibility to run large deficits because it has to make up for the shortfall in demand elsewhere. And that's why these deficits that we've been running have been good, and they would be better if they were larger.
There's confusion and misinformation around the debt and also around quote-unquote entitlements. But then there's a third thing that happens, which is that debt and entitlements becomes a phrase. What's the problem with making that linkage?
First off, you know, I mentioned Social Security and Medicare being the major ones. Social Security actually, as a practical matter, can't contribute to the debt, at least under the law as it's now written, because the way the law is written, Social Security can only spend money that's in the trust fund. So that's the designated Social Security tax and savings from past taxes. They could spend that. But if they ever exceed that, the program has to cut back its spending. So the only way Social Security could ever spend more money than it takes in is if Congress were to change the law. So the idea it's runaway, no, Congress would actually have to change the law for it to be runaway. It can't possibly run away. In terms of Medicare, I guess I'd make two points here. One is that the rise in Medicare costs is driven by the overall rise in health care costs. It's not like we uniquely have a problem with Medicare being out of control. It's health care costs in the U.S. are out of control, and Medicare, of course, pays for health care in the private sector. It's not its own health care program that way. But the other point that, you know, there's too little recognition of, Medicare and actually the finances of Medicare have improved hugely under the Obama administration. I mean, you could decide how much credit you want to give him for that. But the shortfall in the program, projected shortfall, was over 3.5 percentage points of payroll back in 2009 when he first took office. Today, it's just over 0.7 of a percentage point. So the shortfalls has declined by 80%. So the idea somehow, you know, these programs are just, you know, spending crazily and they're going to bankrupt us, A, with Social Security, it's literally not possible unless Congress changes the law. And in the case of Medicare, we've actually have a program that's in much, much better financial shape today, at least by our understanding of it, than it was just 8 years ago. So what's the problem here?
Finally, I think folks think that we're looking at Social Security and Medicare because somehow that is, no matter how we feel about it, it's still a source of a drain, you know, or something like that. And it has to do with what we are able to see. You've even in the budget, you've written about other things that, you know, if we're looking for things that involve a commitment of resources that perhaps future generations should be concerned about. There are other things we could be thinking about, but we're kind of discouraged from doing so.
Yeah, you know, again, at the end of the day, if we're talking about a generational issue, we're handing people whole economies. So on the one hand, you know, one of the things I mentioned in that piece was we have military commitments. You know, again, we could back away from them, but those, are, as we know, are hard to do. I mean, it's not a question of what you or I want. It's what, you know, what's going to be politically viable. So, you know, we're spending a lot of money in Iraq and Afghanistan because, you know, 15 years ago, we made a commitment to go to war there. And we're still spending a lot of money on that. Other areas, and I raise this and people look at me kind of blank-faced, I'll try and make it as simple as possible. Patent monopolies are a way in which the government pays for things. So we give companies a patent monopoly, and that's ostensibly how we're paying for medical research. Mm-hmm. So we're saying, you know, we want Pfizer to research new drugs. You develop a new drug, and we're going to let you charge monopoly prices. That's an effect of tax. So we don't look at that. I mean, I don't know what economic model says we're supposed to ignore it because Pfizer, in effect, is taxing the American people rather than the government. I mean, it has the same impact. And those are very large. In the case of just prescription drugs alone, the amount of, you know, the patent tax, if you like, somewhere in the order of $350 billion a year, about 2% of GDP. It's a huge amount of money. And, of course, we have it in other areas, you know, software, medical equipment, any number of other areas where it's a very big portion of the price of the products. So to pretend that somehow, you know, the deficit or debt is going to be bankrupting our kids and not look at all these other ways that we're imposing burdens on them with our actions today, I'd really be remiss in not mentioning global warming. I mean, this again, you know, somehow let's imagine, you know, 20 years out we could tell our kids, hey, we paid down the debt and then we've destroyed the environment. We'll go, oh, you should thank us. I mean, you know, obviously they should spit in our face. You know, we hand them a whole economy, a whole society, and for that matter, the natural environment, and acting like somehow we're measuring generational equity by the size of the debt is pretty silly.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find his blog, Beat the Press, at their website, CEPR.net. And also, you can find his book there, Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. That's CEPR.net. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.